Coffee with Cudmore.
Light 104.7 and 1570 AM. WVTL.
We welcome Paul Martin to the program, author of Secret Heroes, Everyday Americans Who Shaped Our World. Good morning, Paul.
Hi, Bob.
You had quite an interesting career. You have quite an interesting career. It says you went all over the place with the National Geographic. You spent a year in Vietnam. I realize I just brought up two kind of conflicting things there. But I'm not so much in Vietnam. Maybe you've written about Vietnam, but it's your travels around this country that led you to this book?
It was my travels around this country and my lifelong interest in history. I was an English major and a journalism major, and I probably should have majored in history because I've always had a fascination with history, and strangely, the characters that have always caught my eye are the unsung heroes, the people that you stumble upon and maybe a passing reference, and you realize that this person, you know, deserves to be better known, and so I decided to do something about it. And I wrote this book featuring 30 unknown, unsung heroes, and I really think that they're all people who did amazing things and who deserve to be remembered.
Well, let's go to the book. Hercules Mulligan, who was he?
Hercules Mulligan was one of my favorite characters, and I found him. I was actually looking into the subject of who was the person who received the first military award in our country. And it turned out it was a character named Daniel Knipp, and there wasn't enough information to follow up and write a piece on him, but I found a passing reference in the same material to Hercules Mulligan. Hercules Mulligan was an Irish immigrant who grew up in New York City, and he became a tailor. And he was a very successful tailor, and his most of his clients, this was during the Revolutionary War era in the 1700s, most of his clients were British officers, Army and Navy officers, and he ended up marrying the niece of a British admiral. So he had a lot of contact with the British authorities, but he was patriot, American patriot. He was a member of the Sons of Liberty, and he agitated underground for American liberty. And when the Revolution came along, he was recruited as a spy because of his contacts with the British. And on two occasions, there were British officers in his tailor shop ordering clothes, and in the course of conversation, he uncovered plots to waylay General Washington, and was able to warn him and essentially save his life on two occasions.
Wow, that is something. And, you know, I was just thinking, because you and I chatted about whether you had any heroes right from our area, and not, you don't have them right from our area, but you do have people from New York City, and I suppose Hercules Mulligan qualifies there. But there's one in your book I'd like to ask you about. I just happened to open it up and see her, Defender of the Defenseless, Grace Abbott from Greenwich Village. But one person, if you do a sequel that came from up our way, is one of the early female union leaders, a woman named Leonora Berry, who worked in a knitting mill in Amsterdam. She was a widow, and so she had to work in these mills, which were, you know, maybe the words sweatshop would apply, you know, for very little money. And she became an early figure in the Knights of Labor, which was an early labor union, but they didn't quite know what to do with her, because not only was she advocating for the workers, she was advocating for children's rights, she was advocating for civil rights, and ultimately for the right to vote. I mean, she's never risen to the level of public awareness of somebody like Susan B. Anthony, who, of course, had some ties to this area as well. But she's an interesting individual, Leonora Berry, and I guess I kind of see her as a defender of the defenseless. And what did your defender of the defenseless do?
Well, Grace Abbott sounds very similar to Leonora Berry, and I've written her name down because I do plan to do sequels. Grace Abbott was born in Nebraska. She grew up on the prairie, and she became a school teacher, and she went to Chicago to further her education and went to the University of Chicago. After she graduated, she got a master's degree. She got involved in protecting immigrants. She became the director in 1908 of the Immigrant Protective League, and she was there for 9 years, and she helped protect immigrants against exploitation by banks and made sure that the children got education and that the workers were protected. And her work came to the attention of the federal government, and she was appointed to run the Child Labor Division of the U.S. Children's Bureau, which was a federal office that was charged with looking out for the interests of children all across the country. And she did an amazing job. She impacted millions of lives because she was she promoted information on maternal health care and on infant care, and she improved the infant mortality rate dramatically. We had a horrific level of infant deaths, and she was able to have a big impact on that. She also, during the Depression, was instrumental in fighting childhood malnutrition and juvenile delinquency. Her biggest legacies, though, she actually was the person who wrote the child welfare regulations in the Social Security Act, and then the 1938 Fair Labor Standards Act, which was the law that finally ended child labor. So she had a huge impact on our country, and virtually nobody knows about her.
We're talking with Paul Martin, his book Secret Heroes. We've just gone through this period. I imagine they're gone by now, the cherry blossoms in Washington. But you say they're there because of a woman named Eliza?
Sidmore. And the interesting thing is, most people, I remember being taught in school that First Lady Helen Taft was responsible for bringing the cherry trees to Washington. And that's only partly true. What really happened was Eliza Sidmore, in the 1880s, the Army engineers dredged the Potomac River to fill in marshes along the riverbank in Washington, D.C., and in the process they created what's now Potomac Park and the Tidal Basin. But that land was just raw land, and it was, you know, an eyesore. And Eliza Sidmore was a travel writer, and she'd been to Japan and had seen the flowering cherry trees, and so she came up with the idea of planting cherry trees around the Tidal Basin and Potomac Park, and she actually started lobbying for that in 1895 and never had any success, but she stuck with it with every change in presidential administration. And finally, in 1909, 24 years of pushing this idea, when William Howard Taft came to office, his wife, Helen Taft, both the Tafts had traveled in Japan, so Eliza Sidmore knew they might be sympathetic with her idea, and she approached the First Lady, and Helen Taft got behind the idea, and essentially it came to pass then. So while Helen Taft had a huge role in it and you know, sort of was the catalyst for finally making it happen, the person who came up with the idea and agitated and kept promoting this idea was Eliza Sidmore.
That's something. Now, more modern, if you will, or it seems to me it must be more modern, is this man named Kirk Bloodsworth?
Kirk Bloodsworth. He's actually the only character that's the only living person that's featured in my book. He was unjustly convicted of a rape and murder in Baltimore, Maryland in 1985, and he was originally condemned to death. It was later commuted to two life sentences. But while he was in prison, he happened to read a book about a crime in England that had been solved with through DNA profiling. It was the first time that had ever happened. That was in the 1980s. And Bloodsworth, he had been in prison for 9 years when he finally read this book, and he went to his defense attorney, and they reopened his case. And fortunately, the defense attorney had requested the government to save all of the evidence in his case, and they tested it for DNA, which, you know, they didn't have at the time of his conviction, and they found that he wasn't the person who'd committed this crime. He was released. So he became the first death row inmate to be freed through DNA profiling, and he went on to campaign for other prisoners, and actually there was a law passed as a result of this called the Innocence Protection Act, and people who are convicted of crimes are now automatically tested for DNA, and their DNA is kept on record. So he had a huge impact.
Paul Martin is joining us. Secret Heroes is his book, Everyday Americans Who Shaped Our World. I was going to say something not quite as serious, but it was important. I'm looking here at Clarence Saunders. Clarence Saunders, you describe as the man behind the checkout counter.
He was a real entrepreneur. In 1916 in Memphis, Tennessee, he opened the first grocery store with that wonderful name, Piggly Wiggly. I don't know if you've ever traveled through the southern states, but a lot of southern states have Piggly Wiggly grocery stores. Well, Clarence Saunders, when he opened his store, it was radically different. Prior to that, people went into a store. There weren't grocery stores. There were just general stores, and they'd go in with their list, and they'd hand it to the clerk, and the clerk would scurry around the store and bring everything up to the counter and weigh it out and wrap it up and tie it up in string. And Saunders came up with the idea of prepackaged goods and self-service. Before him, those were unknown. And so he had all of his items on the shelf. Customers could, you know, walk up and down the aisles, pick out what they wanted, and bring it up to the checkout stand. So essentially everything that we encounter today in a modern grocery store, a modern retail store of any sort, self-service shopping, checkout counters, he invented it in 1916.
Isn't that something? And in terms of doing good, that's become a theme on this program today. We're just doing this seed money donation campaign. But there's a man you described, Joseph Dutton, who extended himself to others.
Dutton was an amazing character. He was born before the Civil War, and he served in the Civil War, and afterwards, he got involved in a grisly job. He for 2 years worked digging up the dead and reinterring them in federal military cemeteries. And at the same time, he had a very unhappy marriage that ended in divorce. And because of the depression he had from his job and his marriage, he became a raging alcoholic. And for 10 years, he was just a complete drunk. And when he turned 40, he just turned his life around. He converted to Catholicism, and for a time he lived in a monastery at Gethsemane in the Midwest, and he later decided that he wanted to do something to make amends for his first half of his life, which had been pretty rocky. Mm-hmm. And he heard about the leper colony on Molokai in Hawaii, and he went out to Hawaii and volunteered to help. And the man who was running the leper colony was Father Damien. He was a Belgian priest.
Yeah, yeah.
And Father Damien, in 2009, was actually made a saint for his work on Molokai. Well, as it turned out, Dutton became his right-hand man, and Father Damien had contracted leprosy himself, and he only lived for 3 more years after Dutton got there. In all, Father Damien was in the leper colony for 16 years. And Joseph Dutton, after Father Damien died, ran the leper colony for 41 more years. He never accepted penny in pay. He did everything just as a means of atonement, really. He was felt he had led such a bad life in the first half of his life that he spent the second half of his life caring for these lepers in Hawaii.
Did he contract leprosy?
He never did. And that was one of the amazing things, that he not only showed the compassion, but he showed the world that the fears of leprosy, which is now known as Hansen's disease, were really irrational. It turns out only 4-5% of the world's population is susceptible to contracting leprosy. And he lived for 40 years, took care of their afflictions, and he never contracted the disease. And he also tried to reintegrate the people into larger society. During World War One, he actually sold government bonds and various things that they could invest in to help support the war effort. And it was sort of foreshadowing what today leprosy, Hansen's disease, is easily treatable with drugs, and people are no longer relegated to leper colonies. They live with their families or live in the community, because the disease isn't communicable when they've had this treatment.
you end your book with an afterword in which you kind of plead that people remember these, and not just these people. In fact, you're saying specifically you just kind of scratched the surface with the people you've discussed, but to look for the secret heroes.
It's really true. I mean, everyone, and even I came from a small Midwestern town. I lived in Missouri, grew up in Missouri, in a little town of 8,000. And even there, you know, you could find people who had some key role, say, in the Civil War or what have you. I mean, they're people in every community that have done amazing things. And as I said, for every general on a white horse, there was a foot soldier who struck the blow that turned the tide of battle, so to speak. So I just think that these people deserve to be remembered, and that's what I tried to do in my book.
Well, Paul Martin, author of Secret Heroes. It's a William Morrow paperback original. Thanks very much for joining us. Anything you wanted to say about the book and its availability?
It actually went on sale yesterday. It should be in bookstores, and of course it's also available online through Amazon or Barnes & Noble, but your local bookstore should have it as well.
Paul Martin, the book Secret Heroes. Thanks very much, and have a good day.
Thank you, Bob.
Take care.